A lot of brilliant people have spent time trying to figure out romantic love. Poets, musicians, writers, and just about everybody else. This hour, we're going to let some scientists take a crack at it. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, the science of love. We'll start with attraction and, spoiler alert, a good personality is important. We'll break down the efficacy of pickup lines and we'll talk about falling in love, how we do it, some possible shortcuts we can take, and how love changes us. And finally, since love isn't always forever, we'll also dig into the science of breakups. We know it's hard to do, but we'll find out how we can make getting over a breakup a whole lot easier. Join the conversation after the news.
Universal Time, 16 hours.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Looking for love, falling in love, navigating relationships, getting over a breakup. Most of us have had or will have these experiences, and they all tend to involve a lot of uncertainty and guesswork. Today, we're going to try to clear a few things up and look at love through the lens of science. Gary Ludanowski is here today. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University in New Jersey. He's also the co-founder of the blog, The Science of Relationships. Hello, Gary.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Keith Welker is also here. He's a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. Hello, Keith.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we're going to take sort of a chronological journey through love this hour. So I want to start with attractiveness. And Gary, you have done a lot of research about attractiveness. You've cited a lot of research about attractiveness. And there's the old joke, you know, when you're talking about someone, if you talk too much about what a great personality they have, then they're not very attractive. But it turns out having a great personality contributes to attractiveness. Can you tell me about the research that shows that?
Yeah, absolutely. It turns out that personality goes a long way. And so when looking at people, you can't really help but first notice how physically attractive somebody is. You know, if you're at a bar or a party or in the library, pretty much most often the first information you're going to have about that person is just what they look like. But then if you approach them and you start striking up a conversation, you're going to quickly start learning some things about their personality. So my colleagues and I wanted to see if those subsequent things that we learn about a person's personality actually influence our perceptions of how attractive that person is. And so what we did is we took a whole bunch of pictures that were of slightly above average attractiveness and then paired them with personality information, right? So if we took some moderately attractive individuals and told our participants that these individuals were also smart, they were kind, they were humorous, what we found is when they got to see those pictures again, they actually rated those people as more attractive, right? So by having a good personality, something really, really fair happens, right? And that it makes you more attractive. So personality helps. The really nice thing, though, is it goes the other way, too. So you take somebody who's moderately attractive, and then you find out that they're materialistic, not that smart, mean-spirited, those kinds of things. Having a bad personality and being not a nice person actually made those people appear less attractive, which, again, seems like one of the most cosmically fair things
right.
to have happen, right? It's like, you know, being a bad person actually makes you uglier to other people, which I just find fantastic.
This also, I think, a lot of us have probably experienced the truth of this in our own lives, but it also, I think, has a lot of implications for online dating. So many people meet partners through online dating sites now. I think that tells us quite a lot about what should go into those profiles. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, your profile picture is going to be important, but that might get you sort of in the door, so to speak. I mean, that might draw some attention to your profile, but then how you word your profile and some of the things you put in there and some of the signals that you're sending about the kind of person you are might actually go a long way in helping or hurting how people view you physically.
So people who are already spending a whole lot of time worrying about the words that they put into that profile, we should worry even more, huh?
Yeah, it can certainly influence how people perceive you. And, you know, it's also nice because, you know, not all of us are graced with the physical attractiveness of a supermodel. And so it gives a lot of hope for a really nice way to improve your attractiveness. And, you know, this isn't saying you need to go spend 4 hours a day in the gym. This isn't saying you need to spend a lot of money on makeup and cosmetics and your clothes and all that kind of stuff. Those kinds of things may help. This is just saying simply, you know, be a better person and people are going to find you more physically attractive.
I also want to talk about some other research that you write about on your blog that has some interesting information about men's facial hair and how that affects attractiveness. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of times men are thinking that to be attractive, you take a shower and it's like, do I shave or do I not shave? And a lot of times, you know, guys will default to, you know, sort of the clean shaven look, thinking that women find that more attractive. But in actuality, what women report as being more attractive is heavy stubble. And that they reported that as being more attractive to them than full beards or being clean shaven. And importantly, women prefer heavy stubble, but men actually thought the opposite. Men thought women were going to prefer clean shaven or a beard, but they were wrong, right? So, you know, men can be wrong about things when it comes to relationships, and they're wrong about this. So, and it turns out, you know, women are particularly anti-full beard if they're interested in a short-term relationship. So, you know, something that's not going to last, you know, stand the test of time. And they're actually found clean-shaven least attractive for long-term relationships. So, you know, this Valentine's Day, people should, you know, probably put down their razor if they're thinking, you know, they're going to, the clean-shaven look is the way to go.
All right, so we've talked about full beards and we've talked about clean-shaven, we've talked about stubble. Where do mustaches fall in here?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about the research on mustaches in particular. I mean, we do know that men with full beards are seen by women as being more masculine, socially mature, dominant, aggressive, those kinds of things. So it's possible that a mustache sort of falls somewhere in between, but I'm not aware of research specifically on mustaches.
And did we break beards down at all between maybe a well-groomed beard or a hipster shaggy beard?
I don't believe that they differentiated, though. I believe in that particular study that it was more of the well-groomed beard versus, you know, the Burning Man beard.
So we just all assumed that wasn't attractive? Or
yeah, I think so. And I think that's probably a fairly safe assumption.
All right. Well, I'm there with you. So let's move into the you see someone who you think is attractive or you want to approach someone. Maybe you have a friend that you'd like to take that relationship a little bit further. Before we really get into talking about falling in love, how about pickups? You have broken down pickup lines and looked at those in a scientific way as well.
Right. And so, you know, the way researchers look at these things, you know, the world calls them pickup lines. Researchers call them opening gambits, I suppose, because making things sound like chess makes them sound better. But, you know, the way we look at pickup lines is that there are three main types, right? So there's the first kind is the cute ones. These are the ones that are sort of funny. They're a little bit clever. They're things like, you know, hey, you know, feel my sweater. You know what that's made of? It's made of boyfriend material, right? I mean, it's intended to be sort of clever, funny.
Cheesy.
Yeah, you know, they're sort of, you know, noticeably cheesy. Like, you know, I must be a hunter because I just found a fox.
Ugh.
You know, those kinds of things. So then, you know, that's one type. The second type is sort of innocuous, and that's just a very standard, hi, how you doing? My name's so-and-so, you know, how are you doing today? You know, very simple, very casual, you know, typical kind of opening. The important with those is it's not clear that it's a pickup line per se. It could just be, you know, the normal opening to a typical conversation.
And someone being friendly.
Yeah, you know, I mean, go figure, right? And the other kind is direct, which is a little bit more on the nose about exactly what your intentions are, right? You know, so it's something like, I'm not very good at meeting people like this, but I really wanted to come over and say hi, or, you know, I'm a little bit nervous and I'd really like to get to know you. So it's clear that, you know, this isn't just a standard, hey, how's it going kind of thing. It's, you know, I want to talk to you for a more purposeful reason, but I'm also making sure you know that I'm not trying to be cute and cheesy about this either.
Okay, and what do we know about how those different approaches work, and what affects that?
All right, so I'm gonna ask you. So, as a female, which kind of line do you think is most effective for men to use on women?
I guess I would go with innocuous.
Right. Well, you are exactly right. And that's exactly what the research shows. Any guesses what you think men think is the most effective?
Those obnoxious, cheesy lines.
Absolutely, right? So usually men tend to think that, you know, the cute, cheesy ones, that's the way to go. But really, innocuous is the most effective for females. So when females get a chance to rate these different kinds of lines, they say, you know, innocuous is the way to go. Now, what kind of line do you think is most effective on men?
Direct.
Actually, it doesn't matter. All are the same.
All of them work.
All of them work. You know, it's
okay,
as a guy,
note.
A woman's coming up
take
to talk
note,
to
women.
You.
Take note, women.
Yep. You know, this is a win. And it doesn't really matter what you say. If you say it in English or a foreign language, you're coming up talking to me. This is fantastic.
When I went to college, I asked my brother, how do I know when guys are hitting on me? And he said, well, basically anytime they talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out he was a relationship expert back then, huh?
Yes, there's some truth to that.
So there are different elements that go into how these pickup lines work, though. You've done research that shows when people are worn down or have had a hard day, that affects how they respond, right?
Exactly, right. And so what we look at is a concept known as ego depletion, which is basically, you know, you get this sense of being worn down after you spend an amount of time controlling your impulses, right? So if you want to do something, but you're consistently restricting yourself from doing that thing, that wears you down, right? So if you have a long day at work and really all you want to do is, you know, play on the internet, check your Facebook, but you're at work and you spend all day sort of not checking Facebook, not, you know, avoiding work, that sort of wears you down. And what we found is in our research, with some colleagues of mine at Monmouth, that people who were worn down, when they got the chance to evaluate pickup lines, they were much more receptive to the innocuous, hi, how are you types of pickup lines. But they were also more annoyed by the cheesy lines, right? So one of the cheesy lines we used in the study was, how much does a polar bear weigh? Well enough to break the ice. And so when you're worn down, you know, you just kind of, your impulse to find those cheesy ones annoying gets, you know, amplified because you can't take it anymore.
There's also research that you cite on your blog about how the weather affects our receptivity to pick up lines. Women are more responsive if it's a nice day?
Yep. If the sun is outside and shining, that's a good time to go out and ask women for their number.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about the science of love. We'll move on from attraction and pickups to falling in love here in a moment. With me, Gary Ludanowski. He's professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University. Also here, Keith Welker, postdoctoral researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Folks in Siam do it. Think of Siamese twins, some Argentines without means do it.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the science of love. We've talked about attraction. We've talked about pickup lines. Now we're going to move into falling in love. With me is Gary Ludanowski. He's professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University in New Jersey. He's also co-founder of the blog Science of Relationships. Keith Welker is here, postdoctoral researcher in psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. And all right, so we've gotten through the pickup stage. And I want to ask you first, we're going to get into the idea of self-disclosure here in a moment. And if anyone, and millions of people did, read the article in the New York Times not that long ago in January, to fall in love with anyone, do this. That's what we're going to be talking about in just a moment. But before we get there, Gary, I want to ask you about what research shows us about the difference between how men and women fall in love. What do we know about that?
Well, what the research shows is something that's actually quite interesting. So I think if you walked up to 100 people at the mall or, you know, out on the street and said, who falls in love easier? Is it men or women? I think most people would assume that women fall in love easier. But actually what the research tells us is that they fall in love about the same amount, and falling in love first, they fall in love about the same amount. But men put a little bit more emphasis on physical attractiveness, and they tend to mistakenly overestimate sexual interest from another person. So these factors make men a little bit more likely to fall in love quicker.
Okay, so the love at first sight idea tends to be something that men go for a little bit more?
Exactly right. And actually, women who have a higher sex drive also experience this falling in love easier phenomenon. So really, it's, you know, when you're asking people about how easily they fall in love, men will report falling in love a little bit more. But really what's going on, I think, is that people are mixing up lust for love. And so if you're sort of taking lust and feelings of, you know, high levels of attractiveness and sexual interest, if you're equating that with love, it's just easier to fall in love for anybody if that's how you're approaching love.
All right. Well, let's talk about falling in love. And I mentioned this article, to fall in love with anyone, do this. And the article is based on research that was done about 20 years ago by Arthur Aaron. He succeeded in making two strangers fall in love in his laboratory with this list of 36 questions. And Keith, I know you've done a great deal of research on this as well. This is called self-disclosure. Tell me how this works.
Sure. So rather than, you know, focusing on traits and characteristics that kind of can predict whether people fall in love, like personality or gender or even the weather, you know, this focuses more on processes that are involved in both leading people to be attracted to each other, both as in a romantic way and a sort of friendship way, and things that also sustain closeness. So we have two things that we have identified that are especially important, and one of them is self-disclosure, which is this idea of revealing information about yourself to another person, thoughts, feelings, wishes, intentions. And this is something that is supposed to gradually escalate over time in order to be really effective. You wouldn't start out a conversation with someone, you know, talking about how happy your childhood was, for example. But it's something that starts out with smaller facts and then escalates to larger facts about yourself.
Okay. And where did this list of questions come from?
Sure. So this list of 36 questions, also known by researchers as the fast friends task or activity, basically simulates this gradual escalation of self-disclosure over a brief amount of time, about 45 minutes. And there are three parts to it. The first set has some very low-level self-disclosure questions, things like, would you like to be famous? How would you like to be famous? What is your idea of a perfect day? So these are pretty easy questions to answer. Set two has a little bit deeper questions. So things like, what is your most treasured memory? Or how close and warm is your family? And by the time you get to the third portion of the questions, you know, you're answering questions like, when did you last cry in front of another person? Or, you know, what was an embarrassing moment from your past? And if you started out with part three, that would probably be pretty difficult for people.
Intensely uncomfortable with someone you don't know particularly well. Yeah.
Right. But the idea is this task is a gradual thing. So by the time you have gone through these early low-level self-disclosure questions, you already feel very comfortable about revealing this information about yourself to somebody else by the time you reach that point.
And is this something that you have used in the laboratory? Do you do all the questions at one time?
Yes. So what we have done is we've had couples come into the lab, and we've also had individuals who don't know each other come into the lab sort of as a way to make friends, and then also pairs of couples. And we've had them do this for about 45 minutes. So they answer all of these questions in sequence. And it sounds like a really short amount of time, but I've had participants in some of the studies that I've done. One of them in particular told me it was the best conversation that she'd had in years, which I just found very fascinating.
Absolutely. And so with the people that you have come in, have you had people, individuals that didn't know each other and weren't looking for love necessarily? Have you had people fall in love because of these questions?
Our lab specifically hasn't had, like, tried to create attraction between,
okay,
or at least a romantic attraction. We've tried to create friendships, so we've had same-sex pairs of men and women come in and answer these questions and get to know each other. It's not effective for everyone, but people usually feel much closer to the other person. There are some people who, Gary was talking about, personality differences definitely got revealed, and they didn't hit it off so well. But for couples, self-disclosing, or for people that meet each other, this is a great way to really create closeness between people and have them understand the other person a lot better.
All right. And this article that went viral from the New York Times also talked about the part of the original research that involved staring into someone's eyes for 4 minutes. Is that something you've done in the lab?
That's not something that we've done in the lab, because it's primarily, at least to my knowledge, has been primarily used to create more of a romantic attraction.
Okay.
In our studies, we've also included friendship as part of that. So, if we're having a pair of couples in the lab, we don't necessarily want to create a romantic attraction between the two couples, but rather just a sense of closeness.
Right. Well, and in that research with the couples, if you have two couples going through these questions, what kinds of results have you seen there? I mean, obviously you're looking at friendships, but how does that affect the couples?
Sure. So in many ways, this has kind of created a friendship between the two couples. And it's also, self-disclosure and revealing these thoughts either just with your partner or with your partner and other people seems to increase relationship satisfaction and closeness. But what we actually found was within the pairs of couples, this actually created an increase in passionate love toward romantic partners.
Interesting. So it doesn't even, for a couple that is already in love, it could enhance that feeling.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be so bold to make the claim that this is going to completely rejuvenate your relationship, but this is something that can make you feel more positive, more excited about your romantic partner. And I think over time, having these interactions with other couples and other individuals, having a social network you and your partner can be connected to, and doing these sort of fun activities is something that ultimately can add a lot more excitement to your relationship, in addition to that sense of closeness and warmth that you might feel.
Do you have a favorite question?
Favorite question, huh? I always think for fun questions, I always think it's interesting to hear what people's idea of a perfect day is. You can really learn a lot about a person that way, but it's still a very easy question to answer.
And have you used this in your own personal life?
For me personally, yeah, I've had the idea of trying it. I think it would be a great thing to do at, a small gathering or party to try. I know other people that have done research in this area have used it as a fun activity. So I think it could work well for other people that would like to try it.
We're talking about the science of love this hour with me, Keith Welker. He's a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder. Gary Ludnowski is here, professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University and also co-founder of the blog Science of Relationships. You're welcome to join the conversation as well, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Gary, Keith's been obviously done a lot of research on this self-disclosure idea, but I wonder if you have anything that you want to add to the idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think any time that you're spending sort of dedicated time sitting and talking to somebody, this is a positive thing for relationships, because the more that you've found your romantic relationships on shared interests, mutual friendship, liking and respecting for each other, that increases what we call companionate love. And companionate love is very important for those long-term sustained relationships. And so, if you were to start a relationship using these questions or something along these lines, you're probably going to have a little bit more success in creating a sort of a steady bond that's going to help your relationship. It's much better to base relationships on these types of things than on, just how attractive somebody else is.
Do you feel like this kind of research is in response to our culture losing sort of the art of conversation? Is this something we need help with that maybe we didn't need help with before?
I don't know if it's a response as much as it's a useful tool. And, you know, I think these conversations, and when you see these tasks occur in the lab, what you really see is that there's a little bit of a benefit to having a cheat sheet, right? And so, you know, as Keith pointed out, I mean, some of these people are having some of the best conversations that they've had with people. And, you know, you're having a guide there to ask some of these hard-hitting questions and really questions that are going to reveal things very intentionally about the other person. And, you know, maybe our discourse isn't typically that deep.
So let's say you've fallen in love. You've also done a lot of research about how falling in love and being part of a relationship changes our idea of ourselves. Can you explain that?
Sure, absolutely. So this is what we call self-expansion. So this is some research I did with my graduate mentor, Art Aaron, who also is the same one that came up with the 36-question paradigm. And so the idea here is that we're fundamentally motivated to increase our own capabilities. Like, we want to add qualities and perspectives and identities to who we are as a person, and that our relationships, in particular romantic relationships, are one of the main ways that we do that. And so to test this hypothesis, what Art did with some colleagues was he followed a bunch of people over time. At first, he had them answer the question, who are you today? And so people, you know, spend 2 to 3 minutes writing down all the things that make up who they are, or what we would call their self-concept. Followed those people over a series of months. During that time period, some of those people fell in love and some didn't. After a certain period of time, he measured everybody again, asked them the same exact question, who are you today? And what he found was that those participants who had fallen in love, their sense of self that second time, they had more things to write down, and the diversity of their self-concept was greater. So their self-concept hit on more different areas than it had before. Now, importantly, this also increased their sense of self-efficacy, so that their perception that they could accomplish tasks successfully, and also improve their self-esteem.
All right, so being in a happy relationship created all of this, or does it matter?
Well, I mean, these are early on. I mean, so they're falling in love. So early on, it's really easy to have a happy relationship, and those are the kinds of people we fall in love with. So, over the long term, will any relationship improve the self this way? Probably not. And some of the stuff I've done is looking at the amount of self-expansion within relationships, and these things fall on a continuum. So, you know, once you've been in a relationship for a period of time, some people are going to have partners who greatly contribute to their sense of self, and others not so much. And it's important because the people who are not having these highly expanding, you know, a partner that helps you grow as a person kinds of relationships, we do know from some research, are more likely to cheat, more likely to look at alternative partners, sort of have a wandering eye, so to speak.
So can you give me maybe a for instance, of what a self-expanding relationship looks like? What are some of the elements?
So some of the elements of a self-expanding relationship, your partner introduces you to new things. Right, new perspectives. You know, if you're discussing politics, your partner has a slightly different take than you do. You have shared experiences together that are new, challenging, and interesting. So rather than, you know, sitting home every night doing the exact same thing, you spend time dating still. You know, you travel together to new places. It's really just, you know, sort of infusing your relationship with a lot of novelty. That might not typically happen automatically, right? I mean, relationships take a lot of work. Ironically, early in relationships, we spend a lot of time dating and doing a lot of these self-expanding activities. But over the long term, we get a little bit lazy, a little bit complacent, and discontinue doing that. And what the research is suggesting is that that's really the exact opposite of what you should be doing. You should be spending more time doing these kinds of activities to keep the spark alive, I guess.
Now, as we are in a successful relationship, as time goes by, does that change how we think of ourselves as maybe part of a whole, as opposed to thinking of ourselves as an independent individual?
Absolutely. So, you know, what happens is what we call inclusion of other in the self. And so you stop thinking of yourself as I and me, and you start thinking of we and us. So what happens if you're highly included in the self? Your partner's traits become your own. So if your partner is really humorous, has a fantastic sense of humor, and you don't, if you're highly included, you actually start to think that you have a better sense of humor. And, in fact, you likely probably develop a better sense of humor. And so to the extent you're highly included, if people ask you a question, what do you think about the new Star Wars movie coming out? And you would answer, well, we think it's really exciting, even though you're the only person there. You're just sort of automatically including your partner in your sense of self and in sort of, you know, those self responses. You're much more of a conjoined unit versus two separate individuals.
People like to say that opposites attract, which of course is not a universal truth, but do people tend to grow to be more alike in their relationship?
People do tend to grow to be a little bit more alike. And you're right, opposites don't really attract. We tend to focus on the differences between people, and so, you know, we tend to ignore all the ways in which we're similar. When it comes to attraction, similarity is hugely important. But from a self-expansion perspective, you'd really want to have enough similarity so that you and your partner can get along and can form a relationship, but enough differences to keep it interesting.
All right, we're going to take a short break. And Keith, we need to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Charity.
Keith Welker, postdoctoral researcher at the University of Colorado Boulder. Gary Ludanowski, co-founder of the blog Science of Relationships, is here. And some of these couples will live happily ever after. Some will break up. We'll talk about that next on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Instead of breaking up, I wish that we were making up again.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the science of love. And we've talked about attractiveness. We've talked about falling in love. Now we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about breakups. With me is Gary Ludanowski. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University in New Jersey. He's also co-founder of the blog Science of Relationships. And also joining us now is Grace Larson. Grace Larson has done a great deal of research on relationships as well. She's a graduate student in social psychology at Northwestern University. Hello, Grace.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And now, there are different kinds of breakups. There are the kinds of breakups where you get out of a relationship and you're really happy that you've gotten out of a bad relationship. There are relationships where you don't ever want it to end and it does end. In doing research about breakups, is it important to look at the relationship you're leaving, Grace?
That is an excellent point. And in conducting this study, I was struck by the diversity of responses that people had to their breakups. So the first part of the whole process is to screen people. And so I would have people complete these really quick questionnaires. How long have you been in your relationship? How distressed are you? And there are some people who would say, I just got out of a long relationship a week ago and I am feeling fantastic. It's not stressful at all. There are some people who got out of a short relationship 6 months ago and they're still devastated. They're still pining because that relationship seemed like it could have been the highlight of their life, seemed like it had such high potential. So, I think there's an extreme amount of diversity, and you're definitely going to be affected differently when a relationship ends, depending on the hopes and dreams that you had for it.
And Gary, you've done research about breakups too, and again, we were just talking about those self-expanding relationships, the relationships where your sense of self grows, where you experience new things, you feel like you have become a more confident and more well-rounded person. You have that sense of being a part of a couple, a part of a greater whole. That's got to be a harder kind of relationship to get out of, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, what we found is, you know, we asked people, how are you affected by the breakup? And we found a lot of evidence that people's sense of self was affected, right? So people would say things like, I've lost a big part of myself. Part of my life has vanished. I didn't know who I was. I don't know what to do with myself. And it seems like I feel almost incomplete. And so from seeing that feedback of people experiencing these really devastating effects on the self, we wanted to take a look to see if this was more likely when some relationships ended than others. And, you know, sort of, as you alluded to, people who ended the self-expanding relationships that were adding to their sense of self, they lost more. I mean, essentially they had more to lose because when they're with their partner, they were all these benefits, they were getting all these things added to their sense of self. So when that partner was taken away or when that partner left, the impact on their self was greater.
All right. Now, Grace, you were specifically researching breakups. Can you tell me how you created your study? What was the setup?
Absolutely. Well, I have to give credit to my co-author, David Sabara, who's been studying divorce and breakups a lot longer than I have. And he's conducted several studies where they've used a whole suite of methods to understand different layers of breakup recovery. So they're asking people to talk about their breakup in interviews. They're asking them to give psychophysiological measures that are markers of the amount of physical stress they're experiencing. They're completing these lengthy questionnaires about how they're feeling. And it sparks the question, is making people intensively reflect on their breakup experience actually something that could be hindering their process of getting over it? It sparked this anxiety for both of us of, maybe we should just let people stop thinking about their breakup, stop reminding them that they've gone through this painful experience, and let them move on with their life.
So you were worried that you were making it worse.
There was a little bit of a worry that we were making it worse. Also the hope, though, that, hey, maybe some of these experimental methods are actually somehow helping people move on. And so we conducted one half of the study. We randomly assigned people to either complete a pretty traditional longitudinal study of breakup recovery, that whole set of measures I was just talking about. And then half of the people just completed a relatively short questionnaire when they entered the study and a short questionnaire 9 weeks later. We were asking them, you know, how are you feeling at the start? How are you feeling at the end? But we just didn't bug them in between. And we actually found that the people who were involved in the more intensive half of the study showed a greater recovery of their sense of who they were. And that rediscovery of who they were, in turn, helped them feel recovered more generally. So they said they felt less loneliness. They said that they weren't thinking as obsessively about the breakup.
And how often were they talking about it? How often were they coming in?
Exactly. So for both sets of participants, the study was 9 weeks in length. But for the participants who were in the more traditional intensive measurement version, they came in every 3 weeks. And these experiment sessions lasted from 1 to 2 hours. So we were interacting with them a lot.
Okay. And do you have any idea how much they were talking about their breakups outside of the research?
That is an excellent question, and that's something I'm very curious about. So it might be the case that both groups of people were talking and thinking quite a bit about their breakup sort of with their friends, on their own, and that might imply that what was sort of special about the measurement intensive group and the positive effects that we found had to do with the laboratory setting or the way that we were asking them to talk about their breakup. But on the other hand, if the norm is for people to not think and talk about their breakup very much and instead try to sort of just move on, it's possible that we were, you know, giving people the space to do something they wouldn't have otherwise done. So
right.
A huge open question.
And you found that the people who did talk about their relationships, I mean, what was the difference? How much better was that?
Let's see. It's difficult to quantify, but I think that we're looking at changes over time. So we're looking at their decrease in this sense of having lost who they were, increases in having a sense of rediscovered aspects of themselves that they might have lost during the relationship. And I think it's the difference between very, very small decreases, sort of very, very, very small amount of recovery in the group who didn't come in except for the pre and post visits,
mm-hmm.
and a more dramatic recovery in the measurement intensive group.
All right. So,
sort of taking a flat slope and changing it to a downward sloping line.
So the takeaway is talking about it really helped.
Talking about it in a specific way. So there are actually research findings, a paper by Dave Sabara, in fact, that show that really digging into your deepest feelings about a divorce might actually have a negative effect for people who are already prone to rumination. So it doesn't necessarily seem like it's good to ruminate. It's not good to wallow. It's not even necessarily good to try to dig up your deepest thoughts and feelings about the experience. The way that people were talking about their breakups in our study was to describe the pretty basic objective facts about the breakup. Just tell me what you remember about the first point where you realized that your relationship was ending. And so I suspect that we probably hit on the kind of healthier balance between suppressing your feelings about the breakup, just trying to not think about it at all, versus wallowing and ruminating.
Interesting. Well, Gary, I know you've also done research about breakups and specifically focusing on writing about breakups, which I have to think has something in common with talking about breakups. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, the study I did is very much what Grace is talking about. It's a little bit of that sweet spot where, you know, it was minor enough that people weren't going to get into that deep ruminative state where they're going to sort of wallow in all their negative feelings. But it was just enough to get them to think about it in sort of a systematic, a little bit more objective way to help them process some of those thoughts. And so what we had participants do is we had them in three different groups. I mean, one group wrote about the negative aspects of their breakup. Another group were forced to focus on the positive aspects. Another group wrote about a controlled, neutral topic, which didn't have anything to do with their relationship. And what we found was both the negative group and the positive group improved, right? And they had more positive emotions, less loss of self, those kinds of things. But the positive group had the most benefits. So, you know, this is consistent with some of the work that Jamie Pennybaker has done, where sort of writing about the negative aspects of a bad experience can be quite helpful. It sort of helps you organize your thoughts and process things a little bit. So that did help in this context of breakup as well. But we also had people focus on the positive, and what we found was that helped even more. Because you're kind of getting people to do something that they may not naturally do. After a breakup, you know, it's really natural to feel bad about it, and a lot of times people would just sort of focus on all the bad things that happened. But, you know, like anything else in life, you know, breakups aren't 100% bad, and they're not 100% good. I mean, they're somewhere in the middle, and so getting people to focus on the positive aspects in a way that they might not necessarily do naturally on their own seemed to be really beneficial for people.
We're talking about the science of love today. We're focusing on breakups right now. With me, Gary Ludanowski. He blogs at Science of Relationships. Grace Larson's a graduate student in social psychology at Northwestern University. She's done research on breakups. And I think, you know, when we're in relationships, we don't want to break up. We dread the idea of breaking up. That's not considered to be a positive thing. Is breaking up as bad as we make it out to be, looking at other kinds of research, Grace?
So there's some fascinating findings from Paul Eastwick and Eli Finkel showing that people tend to think breakups are going to be worse than they actually are. They had an ingenious study design where they asked people who are still in relationships, imagine breaking up with your partner. You know, I know it's hard to imagine because you're wildly in love with them right now, but just imagine it. How upset do you think you would be, let's say, a week later? And then they tracked these people over time. So lo and behold, some of them did break up. And they were able to ask them that many weeks later, how distressed are you? And people were reliably less upset, less torn apart than they thought they would be. I think it's exactly what Gary is saying. There are often upsides to a breakup. There are reasons that a relationship ends. And you become aware of those once you've actually split up with the person. And people just tend to recover from stressful situations more quickly than they think they're going to in general.
We're more resilient than we want to give ourselves credit for. Gary, you want to add anything on that?
I mean, I think people in general are just really bad at predicting how they're going to feel about most things, right? You know, I mean, we think we're really good at predicting how we're going to feel. We think we're really good at predicting how we're going to act. And it turns out we're human. We're not. We're actually pretty bad at it. And we're highly overconfident. I mean, people think winning the lottery is going to change their world and make them super happy. And the research really doesn't bear that out.
So when we talk about a bad breakup and we talk about a broken heart, a lot of us have experienced that. But there's actually research that shows that breaking up and being heartbroken can actually equate to physical pain. Grace, you want to fill us in on that?
Yeah, this was an excellent study that was conducted using magnetic resonance imaging. So it was looking at brain activation after a breakup experience. And they had participants look at a photo of their ex-partner and just imagine the rejection that they felt during the breakup. And they found that there was a really shocking degree of overlap between the brain areas that are more active when you're experiencing physical pain and the brain areas that are more active when you're thinking about being rejected by your ex-partner. Relationships are so incredibly important to us. And relationships don't just help us, you know, experience love and pleasure. They also regulate us on this really deep physical level. And so losing a relationship, I think, is a little bit like going cold turkey off of coffee. And your body is going to hurt afterward. And your brain is going to signal to you that something is deeply, deeply wrong. And it uses some of the same areas to signal that something is deeply wrong that are signaled when, you know, your hand is on a hot stove.
Interesting. And now, I'm not a scientist, but I've always had the theory that everybody should have their heart broken at least once. It seems like a time of incredible personal growth once you recover from it. Mm-hmm. Is there any science to bear me out on that, Gary?
Well, I mean, there's definitely science that shows that breakup can be a positive experience for people. It can be this impetus for personal growth, experiencing positive emotions. You know, whether you have to go through a breakup to experience that or not, you probably don't have to go through a breakup. But, I mean, I think there is some wisdom to, you know, breakups can teach us a lot, right? I mean, so relationships can teach us a lot. And, you know, the chances of us falling in love the first time with the person who's perfect for us for the rest of our lives, it's pretty slim. And so, you know, our series of relationship experiences and, you know, so things beginning and ending, each of those are an opportunity for us to learn a little bit about relationships that will help us once we really do find that perfect partner for us.
Now, a lot of people who break up end up getting back together. What do we know about how a breakup can influence a relationship after people are reunited?
So I know that there is some research indicating that on-again, off-again relationships tend to have lower quality. Even if the relationship sticks, and people end up in a period where they're pretty stable together, the relationship tends to be a less happy one, a less stable one. So I think that would be a cautionary tale against getting back together with somebody.
All right, Gary?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, these cyclical types of relationships tend to prolong the pain of the breakup, where, you know, if you're in a high-quality relationship with someone you consider your best friend, as relationships should, if you decide to break up, I mean, that's a pretty big decision, and one that is probably predicated on some sort of relationship dynamic that isn't quite right. And so once you've decided to take that step, getting back, you know, it broke for a reason, and so, you know, it's probably just best to go cold turkey and make it a clean break.
All right. Gary Ludanowski, thank you so much for being here today.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Gary Ludanowski is professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at Monmouth University in New Jersey. He's also co-founder of the blog Science of Relationships. Grace Larson, thank you.
Thank you.
Grace Larson is a graduate student in social psychology at Northwestern University. She's studied breakups, but we're going to end on a more positive note today with a little bit of Al Green. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Let me be the one you come running to. I'll never be.